Welcome to The Read-Along,
a mini book club for your ears.
I'm your host, Scott.
I'm your other host, Anita.
And join us on a journey through a good book,
one chapter at a time.
Do you like talking about movies? Do you like talking about mediocre movies? Do you like talking about how you could have fixed mediocre movies? Well, I certainly do, and you can listen to me, Scott C. Bourgeois, along with my co-hosts Greg Beaver and Liam Creswick, as we give our notes, and I have some notes. You can follow it now on your podcatcher of choice or support it by visiting patreon.com/ihavesomenotes. When was the last time you just mainlined a whole bunch of Monty Python?
It's been a while.
Yeah.
At least until recently.
Well, that's what we did over the weekend.
It was great.
We had some friends over. One of them had wanted to, for his birthday, do basically a Monty Python marathon.
A movie marathon.
Yeah.
Should clarify.
So we watched all five of the Monty Python movies. And it was great.
Yeah. Well, we should clarify, theatrically released.
Yes, that was the criteria.
Full-length Monty Python movies. Otherwise, things go crazy. There's a lot of Python out there.
Yeah, so we watched, in order, and now for something completely different,
mm-hmm.
Monty Python and the Holy Grail,
mm-hmm.
Life of Brian. Then we flipped the last two around so that there wouldn't be quite as much initial repetition.
Yes.
And then we watched Meaning of Life and then Live at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
So... got a lot of Python in
this
weekend.
It was very good.
Yeah.
I am impressed that I remembered most of the lyrics to most of the songs. Like, well done, brain.
Yeah. It was a good time. My face hurt from smiling at one point. Because there was much laughter and mirth to be had.
It was a really good time.
Yeah. So that's what we did this weekend.
How about you?
And then we read some book.
Yeah. As you do.
As you do. So,
we should talk about book. We've already talked about Python.
It's true.
All right.
So a brief recap of our previous chapter in which Mallory and Theodore set to work with their mass spectrometer to do some magic science with a little assistance from Diana. And they discover a breakthrough in forensic magical science.
Color coding.
Yes, color coding.
Magical color coding.
Mallory also manages to really just step her entire foot right into her mouth. And slightly insult her friends, but thankfully, everybody's in a forgiving mood. They also make a date with Observer Johnson at the observatory to catch up on religious matters. And that is actually where we find ourselves as we head into Chapter 14 of The Undetectables by Courtney Smith. So we pick back up basically right at the observatory.
Yeah, more or less. We just sort of skip the travel time.
Yeah, Mallory and Cornelia and Diana have arrived with a plan to basically get a refresher because they're non-practicing witches. Or occultists.
Yes, that's better. I rolled my eyes right at the beginning of this chapter. Like, it's the best excuse we could come up with. I was like, really? Really? The best excuse you come up with is that you just wanted a refresher?
The best excuse they could come up with in 5 minutes the ride over.
I came up with a much better excuse in 4 minutes.
And what was that?
You don't have to say, oh, we just need a refresher. That's weird and out of place. If you say, listen, we've been having theological debates and we need some expertise, then at least that promotes question and discussion and without making them look creepy for asking all the weird questions that made them look creepy.
Yeah, they do ask a lot of creepy questions, which make them look creepy. The observatory is quite nice.
Yeah, it sounded beautiful.
It's a fairly intricate facility, apparently. It's intimated that the observatories that we have in the Mundy world are based on occult observatories, but are like pale imitations.
Yeah, well, we're just looking at stars.
And they're looking at magic.
I'm I don't know why that tickled me so much.
At any rate, also, Observer Johnson's, like, priestly garment is basically like an old-timey wizard robe.
It sounded like an old-timey wizard
like
robe.
Like, it's described as a navy blue robe with, like, gold stars on it.
Yeah, well, yellow stars, but I imagine them gold in my head, too.
Yeah.
Like, this flowing robe, like, that looks like the night sky. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Here's the terrible truth about this, is that I recently saw a kid's bathrobe that had that exact pattern on it, and I was like, oh, it looks like a wizard robe. I want one. But there wasn't one in an adult size, and I've been secretly looking for one since.
Oh, I'll keep my eyes open for you.
But that is basically what he's wearing. He is dressed like an old-timey wizard.
I love it.
And at first, he's a little curious why they've come asking questions. And he has a vague recollection of who they are, because he's got a good memory for people, and he, like, did their baptism, their occult baptism.
Yeah.
But he knows Cornelia immediately. He's like, oh, yeah, you're trouble.
I was just going to say, like, he clocks her immediately.
Yeah, and it kind of puts him on edge. And, I mean, their line of questioning also very quickly, like, sours him to this conversation.
Right.
Because they're asking some borderline sacrilegious questions of him.
Right, exactly.
And they can't explain to him why, because as per the orders of the Nightmare, they're trying to be discreet in their investigation.
Right.
So they can't just come out and say, hey, we're investigating these murders. We found this weird clue. You might be able to help us with that. Which, the truth is, would probably make him much more inclined to help them.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, I know. Which is why I, in my head, a better excuse would be, we've been having a lot of theological discussions.
Yeah.
And, like, we're not going to pursue this path, but we're curious about knowledge.
Yeah.
That, I think, would track better. And, yes, because of this investigation, they have to ask, like, the borderline sacrilegious questions.
Because someone is potentially committing sacrilege.
Exactly. And yeah. It just makes them look bad and makes him not want to talk to them.
Yeah. But they do manage to get some useful information out of him, which potentially sheds a great deal of light on the motive of the killer.
Yes.
We say potentially because we don't know for sure, but it's definitely some solid conjecture.
Yes.
And it stems around their key question of, hey, what's up with the symbol that's on the window? Which is, of course, the symbol that's being carved into the bodies.
Yes.
And he's like, oh, well, here's the deal. That is like a very magical symbol that was carved using a blade of doom, this yeah. great death blade.
It was done by Elisa Bella because she was the only one, like, strong enough.
Well, because she governs kind of creation.
Yeah. She's the one with the powerful enough magic, right? And
yeah.
I also got the impression that it was also a strength of will thing as well that was involved in the creation of this symbol. And it's actually very, very difficult to do.
Yeah.
Right? Like, replicating it would be nigh impossible, right?
Without using the very implement that she used to begin with.
Exactly. Which brings these magical carvings, like, sharply into question.
Indeed.
About how that's being done.
And they even suspect that maybe somebody's been using the evil knife that she used to make this beautiful creation with.
Right.
But that's getting a little ahead of ourselves. They also ask, like, okay, so why would somebody theoretically want to maybe reproduce this symbol? And he's like, well, the only reason I could possibly fathom would be that somebody might be trying to summon the Turnian back into this world.
Yeah. But then we get into sacrilege again, because to do so would be just, like, horrendous.
Well, yeah, because basically their apotheosis is the crux of having stopped the Vampire Wars. Like, them being gods is part of the covenant that ended that business. And apparently, it was a good thing.
Well,
like,
at least according to Observer Johnson, right?
Yeah.
He starts out with, like, you probably learned that the Turnian came into being around the end of the Vampire Wars. And then he puts forward his theory that it was the reason for the end of the Vampire Wars.
They basically became gods and used their power to put an end to things.
Yeah.
And as he puts it, like, even the vampires were happy about this because the majority of them did not sanction what came from the war.
Yeah, exactly. Most vampires did not want to be part of a vampire war.
Yeah, they were pretty happy to have that business wrapped up. And that's why things are pretty kosher nowadays.
Yeah.
But if somebody were to summon the Turnian back into this world, that would essentially nullify this covenant. And the vampire wars could potentially restart.
Yes.
And that would be very bad.
Very bad.
Because the vampire wars weren't just a war between vampires and everybody else. He actually suggests that it was a war between all of a culture.
Yeah, and all of a culture going back to war would more or less end reality as we know it.
Because one a culture would have to become the dominant a culture. It would have to be victorious.
Yes.
And then that would also consume the apparent world, and then it would essentially be the end of the world.
Yeah, exactly. Like, everything over with.
Certainly everything as we know it over with.
Yes, exactly.
So this greatly spooks our three detectives.
Oh, deeply, deeply disturbs them.
Because if somebody's been doing this sacrilegious carving on these bodies in the lead up to Samhain, a time when the veil between worlds is at its weakest, it certainly implies to them that someone is indeed trying to summon the Turnian and thus restart the vampire wars.
Yeah, like that's really, really what it looks like right now.
And that would be very bad. This also leads to another little possible clue. Because while they're discussing the vampire wars and, like, well, borrowing power and how vampires were borrowing power in order to do the atrocities they were doing, or at least the bad vampires, Cornelia gets real nervous about this and is like, but I mean, like, if it's consensual, then it wouldn't be a problem, right? Like, it's okay if somebody lends a vampire their power and it's something that they've agreed to and they're not stealing it. And, like, Cornelia, you've been giving Beckett your power, haven't you?
She had that question about consent.
Yep.
Right? Like, it's like, oh no. Like, what have you been talked into?
And more than that, like, she's clearly very worried because the other two have already clocked Beckett as a suspect.
Right?
Yeah. So, like, that's not a good look for Cornelia in this moment. Does that mean Beckett is actually the killer? Hard to say at this juncture, but as we've pointed out a couple times previous, he seems to be almost too obviously up to something.
And like blatantly, like overly.
Yeah.
Right?
But at the moment, he's also the one suspect who we have the most, let's say, circumstantial evidence about. Because the truth is, while we know Grey Quinn and the Nightmare are up to something, it doesn't necessarily add up to murder. It adds up to something shady. They have something to hide. They're doing some dirty business, but it doesn't necessarily mean one or both of them are trying to end the world.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know anything about Detective O'Sullivan.
No.
Like, virtually nothing, except that she was clocked as suspicious previously by both Diana and by the comments of the police, and that's why she's up on the suspect board. But we don't really have anything else to go on for her.
Hardly anything, no.
So it's hard to say of our four suspects if there's someone more suspicious. We don't really know much about Grey Quinn, other than he's involved in the Nightmare's shady business. And I'm inclined to say the Nightmare is likely not the killer, because why would he have hired the girls to investigate his own murders? Previously, we had maybe suggested that it could be just for show.
One of those, there are so many murder mysteries that I've consumed in some way that where it's the killer is the one who hires the detective
to help cover their own tracks.
Because they think they're smart enough that they're going to get away with it, they fooled the detective. There's that whole Moriarty theme to it, like they want to be caught.
Or they think that it'll make them look more innocent because, well, why would I have hired a detective to solve the murder that I committed?
Yes, exactly. Like it's almost a cliche.
But that's always performative. And the thing with this that makes that weird is that the Nightmare explicitly doesn't want a performative investigation.
Yes.
He wants them to keep it quiet. So even if he had hired the worst detectives in town to make a show of investigating, he specifically didn't want them to make a show of investigating. And that undercuts the whole idea of it.
Right.
So that, if anything, makes him seem less suspicious to me.
I know. As we've been discussing this, I'm starting to wonder if Cornelia is accidentally in something over her head.
Oh, I think she absolutely is. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Beckett is the killer.
No, it doesn't. But I'm starting to wonder if she's involved with Beckett as some sort of like anti-establishment group, right? And doesn't realize the depth of it.
Potentially, yeah.
Right? Doesn't fully understand maybe what she's gotten into, and maybe it's not exactly what she thinks it is.
You're suggesting that Cornelia is being used.
Yes.
And hasn't clocked that she's being used.
Yes.
I believe it.
That is exactly what I am suggesting.
I believe it.
Just based on how she is acting about it.
Here's the thing about Cornelia. She grew up with a silver spoon in her mouth.
Yes.
And so she lacks, on her D&D chart, wisdom. She has charisma and she has intelligence and she has wisdom as a dump stat. Mm. That's what I'm reading from her so far.
Yeah, that kind of tracks. Yeah. I'm worried that her naivete
is being taken advantage of.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very possible. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean that Beckett is himself the killer.
No. No, it does not.
And again, it seems almost too obvious.
That's what I keep saying.
Yeah.
That, like, it's so blatantly pointing at Beckett that I feel like it's too easy to label him as the killer right now and be like, we solved it.
In fairness, we have in the past written off potential suspects as too obvious in previous books, who then were definitely the killer.
I know. Irresponsible speculation is our specialty over here.
Are you willing to go as far as to j'accuse, to go into the accusing parley right now?
Goodness no.
Okay.
Again, I think it's too obvious.
I'm going to put the key to the accusing parlor back in my pocket.
Just tuck it in. We'll storm in there when we're ready.
Yeah. And again, we don't know much about O'Sullivan or really enough about Great Quinn at the moment.
Exactly.
To make a solid judgment against both of them. We have a mountain of circumstantial evidence against Beckett. Nothing damning. And really not much for anybody else.
See, exactly. We haven't ruled out everybody. And we have nothing solid on our lead suspect. So you put the key away.
Okay. But that's basically the chapter. Is they leave spooked that they've accidentally stumbled into a situation where they might be the only people about to prevent the end of the world.
Maybe.
I mean, if you want to raise the stakes, they don't get much higher than that.
It's true. Before we finish our episode, though, I do want to give a quick shout out to the wonderful, like, borderline slapstick entrance that they had into the observatory. Cornelia turns too hard and gets wrapped up in a curtain, like Guy Smiley-esque, right? And she kind of, it's all very silly and goofy for, like, three paragraphs.
Observer Johnson is just like, please get out.
Please just get out of the curtain. Stop
out,
it.
Stop.
It was just this beautiful little piece of humor that I appreciated.
He does actually, I should also mention, point them at one last clue, which is that they should get their hands on a specific book.
Yes.
Which he is unwilling to lend them.
No, because it's his copy.
And because he doesn't trust them.
Yeah. To be fair, it's probably, like, you know, has some manner of historical or religious significance to the observatory.
Quite possible. Right?
Like, you can go to the bookstore and get a Bible. You don't take the one from the parish.
Yeah, well, that's fair.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So we'll have to find out if they're able to get their hands on one quickly and what further revelations may lie in store.
I imagine it will not be difficult for Cornelia to procure a copy of this book.
Indeed. Perhaps she will have one as soon as next chapter, which would be chapter 15 of our novel. You'll want to read up on that in time for next week. And as always, in the meantime, you can give us a little rating and a review.
Oh, because we appreciate those very much.
We do indeed. You can also send us messages via social media.
All right, here's the whole list. X, Facebook, Instagram, Goodreads, and Blue Sky. Right?
Yes.
That's all of them. Yeah. We are at The Read Along on most of them.
Correct. We're also on Threads. But anyway.
Threads is part of Instagram. Though,
yeah, that's
it?
Fair. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway. And of course, email. You can send us one of those.
Oh, absolutely. That's way easier. You can find us at thereadalong@gmail.com.
And with that said, as always, we love you very much and we'll see you next time.
Guy smiling in the curtains.
Thank you for joining us on The Read Along with your hosts, Anita and Scott Bourgeois. All Read Along music is by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Cover art is by Aaron Beaver. Be sure to join us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Read Along, and check out our group on Goodreads.com.